Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now we continue our midterm election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. We're in the middle of a three-episode stretch on the culture wars in public education. Yesterday we talked about sex ed as a hot-button issue in the Tom Malinowski versus Tom Kane congressional race in New Jersey. Today for Issue 7 on 30 Issues in 30 Days, we'll focus on the teaching of American history as a culture war and electoral issue. It's one that Republican candidates tend to raise much more than Democrats, though one of the guests we're about to have on will say Democrats should be doing their own version of it, or at least engaging in this more actively than they are. President Trump, to take one obvious example, promoted a teaching of American history that he called the 1776 Project, that focuses on teaching patriotism. It was part of his response to the New York Times 1619 Project, which told the story of how slavery and racism have been central to American history, beginning in that year, 1619, when the first enslaved Africans were brought here. So we'll talk now about the politics and also about how to teach history so it doesn't gloss over reality, but doesn't leave the country divided into racial or political camps to the extent that that's even possible. With us now are John Vallant, director of the Brown Center on Education Policy and a senior fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and Peniel Joseph, founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy and professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. He was here recently, some of you may recall, for his new book that's relevant to this topic called The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. So, Peniel, welcome back. And John, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Great to be back. Brian. Come on.
So, John, one of your recent Brookings articles is called Democrats Should Engage in Education Politics So Kids Don't Have to. And it begins with a victory last year for governor of Virginia of Republican Glenn Youngkin. Can you remind us of the place that teaching about history and so-called critical race theory played in his campaign?
Sure, and thanks. So really, it's been a bumpy couple of years for schools when it comes to education politics. So typically, we don't see education at sort of the forefront of the American political conversation. But really, for the last couple of years, at a lot of times, it has been. And that's sort of unusual for us. And a lot of that very likely has roots in the school shutdowns that came after the sort of initial wave of the pandemic. But it's kind of expanded, and it's touched in a lot of other issues in a lot of other areas. And so that Virginia gubernatorial election, which was last November, was where we really saw in this race between Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, and Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat, we really saw education bubble up. And there was a gaffe by McAuliffe where he said that he doesn't think that parents should be telling schools what they should teach. That was sort of really in the context of where we had been, where a lot of parents felt like they didn't have enough say over what their kids were doing, felt like a political sin to say that. And that race became then, it sort of added fuel to this idea of parents' rights. And a lot of Republicans sort of grabbed onto this idea that parents ought to have more control over what's happening in their kids' education. And some of that was sort of directly related to pandemic issues. So it was about masking, and it was about vaccines and some of those kinds of things. But a lot of it had to do, or has come to have to do, with other issues related to how history is taught and which books you find on bookshelves and what schools say about gender and sexuality. And so these issues that feel like in a lot of ways they're rooted in the pandemic have over time come to really encompass a lot of social issues and a lot of culture war issues that we're more and more finding in schools.
You also refer in your article to book bans premised on the idea that even math books are infused with critical race theory. What's an example or two of what's being targeted?
That's right. So that comes from Florida, where we've seen, and it's not just Florida. So Governor DeSantis.
But of course, Florida, but you weren't listening to our last segment, so go ahead.
Right, yeah. And I mean, Florida is there's no shortage of education stories coming out of Florida these days, because Governor DeSantis has really been at sort of the forefront of a lot of these attacks on schools. And in Florida and in other states and in other localities, we're seeing more and more these kind of pushes. Often they're anti-critical race theory pushes. They're framed as that, as being anti-CRT, and they'll have different parts to it. And some of it is sort of taking a look at all of those books that are on library shelves, whether it's in school libraries or it's in classrooms. And, you know, it those nets are capturing a whole lot of books that I think the vast majority of parents would not find objectionable in any way, and in fact would find to be exactly the types of books that we want kids to see, because they have people who look like them and stories that resonate. And so in Florida, as in other states, there was sort of this look at the curriculum, and in Florida in particular, look at the math curriculum that ended up flagging a whole bunch of textbooks, in some cases because of claims that they were sort of promoting critical race theory, which to my eye is quite a stretch.
Peniel, I want to ask you about the actual teaching of history, since that's part of what you do at UT. But do you want to give us your take on the politics of this as you see it? Like, how does this fit in with the premise of your book that the U.S. right now is in a period that you call the Third Reconstruction?
Well, absolutely, Brian. You know, the whole critical race theory controversy is a hoax for the elimination of truth teaching in U.S. history. And it goes back to the Lost Cause, which was also a hoax, but became institutionalized in the 19th and the 20th century, and still in the 21st century. And the Lost Cause is this story of American history that tells us the Civil War was a bad thing, Black citizenship and dignity was a terrible thing, the Klan were heroes, and Black men were rapists. And that's the Lost Cause that Archibald Dunning at Columbia University institutionalized in textbooks. John F. Kennedy learned that Lost Cause, racist history, at Harvard University. And the whole idea of CRT is to ensure that the Lost Cause remains in the Florida and Virginia and all these different K-12 public school curriculum. So we have to really stop talking about CRT and say, look, this is a hoax and this is against the truth teaching in American history. They don't want us to talk about anti-Semitism, Brian. They don't want us to talk about settler colonialism and what happened to indigenous people. They don't want us to talk about the Chinese Exclusion Acts and what they've done to Asian American Pacific Islanders. They don't want us to talk about the Braceros program or even what we did earlier in the 19th century to Mexico, including having Confederates who brought enslaved Africans to Mexico so they can continue to perpetuate slavery, and all the land theft in Mexico and the killing of both Mexicans and indigenous people in Mexico. We have a long, long, terrible history in this country, but we also have a history that is more beautiful because we have a history of resistance to racism and anti-Semitism and slavery and imperialism. So we have this abolitionist democracy legacy, and that's what they're calling critical race theory. So they're calling, you know, Susan B. Anthony is this progressive feminist. They're calling Ida B. Wells. They're calling, you know, Rabbi Abraham Heschel. The whole area where we've tried to have multiracial democracy, the Reconstructionist legacy of the Civil War, becomes smeared and becomes a scandal when we think about the Lost Cause. So all we're seeing with it's not a 1776 patriotic project, because it's rooted in the Confederacy, and the Confederacy was a white supremacist anti-American project. And when we think about this in the 21st century, part of what conservatives and Republicans and white supremacists have been able to do is control the language. So they turn critical race theory, they turn terms like woke into really new racial epithets and anti-Semitic slurs. These are the same people who in January 6, 2021, stormed into the Capitol with Confederate flags, but also anti-Semitic symbols. So this is all of a piece, and we have to have the language. Toni Morrison teaches us that language is power, and we have to understand and utilize the language that they're trying to stop truth teaching. CRT is a hoax, wokeness is a hoax, and move and articulate our reasonings accordingly.
So what so we that articulate some of the worst of what's going on that side. Some conservatives would say they're playing defense, not offense here, though, that things like the 1619 Project, but many other things as well, portray the United States as too resistant to anti-racist progress. And when it becomes curriculum rather than just published work, like in the New York Times, it leaves white kids feeling like they're inherently bad and the country is inherently bad, and doesn't do enough to acknowledge, they would say, that many thousands of white Northerners fought and died in the Civil War to abolish slavery, that the Constitution was amended to make all people equal eventually, that that battle was fought again in the Civil Rights era to abolish Jim Crow, which a mostly white U.S. Congress finally did. And that's as important as the racism that is obviously also real. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would say that, one, I'm teaching the 1619 Project in a graduate seminar right now. I'm on my third reading of that book. And if anything, it's the direct opposite of what they're claiming. It's extremely patriotic and sort of veneration of America and American democracy and the role that Black people, at times Native people, at times white people, played in transforming this a republic of slavery into a multiracial democracy. Second, I would say when it comes to white children, one of the things that they should be very proud of is the abolitionist legacy that is talked about in the 1619 Project, that's talked about in all of African-American history, that includes white abolitionists. My book talks about Thaddeus Stevens and how important Thaddeus Stevens was during the period of Reconstruction to secure citizenship and dignity, to at least try through the law and legislation. So part of this is an excuse in the sense that it's not the teachers who are teaching, whether it's a 1619 Project or truth teaching, who put up these Confederate monuments to white supremacists and murderers and people who wanted to commit genocide against Black people and Native people. I would love to put up monuments to abolitionists, including white abolitionists who did the right thing during the 19th century, and abolitionists who continued into the 20th and the 21st century. So we have a problem because we refuse to venerate the good people who tried to transform this country. And then when we talk about the bad people, people say we are hating the country. Truth teaching, if anything, is about loving the United States, but loving a particular vision and version of the United States that is inclusive, that is against racism, against anti-Semitism, that basically says either we all count or none of us counts, right? And that shouldn't make any of us upset. That is an expansion of the Constitution, an expansion of 1776 and the Declaration of Independence. Because we can never forget, when those things were written, Black people were enslaved, Native American people were being hunted and marginalized and killed, women had no rights, poor people had no rights, children could still work in factories. So we've transformed because of the good people in the United States of America. And we need to talk about that history alongside of the bad. So Dr. King said we had to talk about the bitter but beautiful struggle to transform American democracy.
Listeners, if we have any history teachers out there or former history teachers, parents too, on how your kids are being taught race and history at any grade level, but teachers, we would love to hear from you as well. I know it's a school day, so many current teachers are probably not out there right now. But I know some of you listen on your prep periods, which is awesome when you call in from there. And some of you may be home on COVID protocol or whatever. So history teachers or teachers in the lower grades, how do you teach race in American history in a way to either avoid a culture war among the parents of your students or to fight it if you see a role that way on whatever side you think is right? Teachers and parents on race as a flashpoint in the education culture wars and how that plays out in elections these days as well. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet for Peniel Joseph, who was just speaking, from the University of Texas at Austin, and John Vallant from the Brookings Institution. And John, when you write for Brookings that Democrats should engage more in these education politics so kids don't have to, that was the title of your recent article, What do you mean that Democratic politicians should be doing more of?
Yeah, so I think part of this is that it has felt like a very one-sided debate. We've had Republicans who have engaged really aggressively and really taken control of the language, as Dr. Joseph said, and taken control of these terms and sort of pushed and made a case that it is the left that is sort of extreme when it comes to what they have in mind for schools and education policy. And oftentimes, those claims just have not been responded to. And so when you let them linger and you sort of let these ideas fester and they sit out there, they become real in a lot of people's minds. And in my view, the Democratic Party has been much too timid in countering some of those ideas. And in some cases, that's pointing to the most extreme ideas and just in communicating that most Americans don't agree with this stuff. They don't want to go book by book in school libraries and take books off of shelves, you know, in the name of keeping kids from learning all of that beauty and ugliness that is our history and is our culture. Parents don't want that. They don't want the Holocaust to be taught as sort of a both sides question. And really, it's been sort of one-sided. So it's been Republicans who have been willing to engage, and Democrats much less so. And I mean, in my view, we have these elections coming up now in November, and I think it's unlikely in November that come November 9th, the day after the midterms, that we're going to be talking about education as sort of the core issue in this election. I think that the national conversation is probably going to be abortion or inflation or crime or democracy or some of the issues that are sort of becoming really prominent in political discussions right now. But in a whole bunch of other races around the country, whether they're the 36 gubernatorial races that are being challenged here this year, or it's state superintendent races or local school board races, a lot of those issues really can matter. And so my view is that Democrats ought to be engaging on these issues, partly for their own political benefit, because again, you need to sort of stay engaged. And the American public for a very long time has been sympathetic toward Democratic ideas when it comes to education, but also for the sake of students. And so just to pick an example or two, a lot of these attacks of late have been made against transgender students, often in ways that are sort of outrageously unfair and cruel. And they have not been responded to. And there are students who hear those messages and see that there's not a strong enough fight in response, and it's bad for students. And then here on this topic of critical race theory in particular, and sort of who owns that language, just as one example of where this language matters, in schools, we've recently seen this fusion of the term critical race theory with the term social emotional learning. And in schools, for decades, the idea of social emotional learning has been completely uncontroversial. It's the idea that we should sort of give kids the skills, the knowledge, and the dispositions they need to have good self-identities and to engage well with others and build strong relationships. And of late, in a whole bunch of states, we're starting to see policymakers talk about how social emotional learning is really a Trojan horse for critical race theory, which is absurd, and it's not true. And when that happens, you get changes in policy that affect students. And so in my view, I would like to see Democrats engage much more forcefully. And I think in doing that, that doesn't mean they have to make it the most prominent issue in an election. But in engaging, I think you can both sort of stave off some of the harm that comes. And also, I think it would be in their own benefit politically.
If so much of this is a hoax, as Peniel describes it, and I think you would agree with that, why do you think it's so politically powerful and catches on? And even more so, since you say that the Democratic Party's position on education issues generally, good funding for education, things like that, doesn't drown it out.
So I think a lot of it has to do with our context. And a whole lot of these issues grew out of the pandemic, where there was very real frustration and anger about how schools responded to the pandemic. And from that context, we had, and also sort of, you know, that is around the time when Black Lives Matter was gaining its most prominence. And some of these culture issues that have grown out of that, whether it's CRT, you know, that sort of anti-CRT movement, or it's the anti-trans student movement. Some of those kinds of things I don't think are fundamentally about issues in schools. I think that like schools sort of became a vehicle for fighting a whole lot of other political battles. And the sort of unifying theme in a lot of those has been parents' rights. And politically, parents' rights is a very clever phrase. I mean, it's, you know, everyone likes having rights. People particularly like having rights when it comes to their kids, which is, you know, the most important thing in a whole lot of people's lives. And parents' rights, when you sort of think about what it means, it can mean anything to anyone. So you could say that as a parent, you have a right to, you know, not have your kid wear a mask in school. You could at the same time say you have a right to have your kid go into a school environment where other kids are wearing masks so your kid is safe. It's like one of those phrases that has a lot of punch and it resonates with people emotionally, but it doesn't actually have a lot of substance. So it's very hard to fight against. And I think that is sort of where we are, is that we have these terms and these ideas that are sort of vague and hard to fight back against in some ways, but they do have some real bite politically.
A few more minutes on issue 6 in our 30 issues in 30 days midterm election series. Issue 6 is the teaching of American history as an education culture wars flashpoint in the elections. And Stavros in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Stavros.
Good morning, Brian. Hi. Love your show. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
Oh, good. I love what your guest said about identity and our national identity. And indeed, he's correct when he says there are wounds to identify with and healing to identify with. And healing requires atonement. Now, you look back at the history of Germany. I'd like to ask your guests, like, what can we learn from Germany, how they teach Nazi history to students? Like, what are they doing? How have they done it? I know they've done it. I have German friends who did school trips to concentration camps. So what can we learn?
It's a great question. So Peniel, is it a comparison you've thought about as a history teacher at the university level?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what Germany has done is placed the whole history of the Holocaust in a panoramic way in its curriculum, in its built environment, the wrongs that have been done. They've tried to atone through reparations to specific Jewish communities and families whose fortunes were stolen by the Nazis and during the Second World War. They don't have monuments to Hitler and to the Third Reich. Instead, they have a built environment and landscape where you can see and acknowledge what happened so that it would never happen again, you know? And it doesn't mean that Germany doesn't still have small groups of right-wing white supremacist fascists, but as a whole, they've come to terms and come to grips with what they did in terms of the massive, the genocide against 6 million Jews. They've come to much better terms with it than what we've done here vis-a-vis slavery and what we've done to other groups. So that hasn't made young German kids hate themselves because they learn about German complicity in the Holocaust. If anything, it's made them much more complicated and empathetic actors on the global stage and within their own country. So that's a great example of where we could move forward to some kind of truth, justice, and reconciliation. Obviously, South Africa had truth, justice, and reconciliation commissions where people were able to acknowledge the wrongs that were done during apartheid. These things are always going to be imperfect, but the United States does the exact opposite and runs away from the truth and continues to perpetuate this lost cause lie that is connected to CRT, connected to the anti-wokeness. There's always a ready group of white Americans and at times people of color who are redemptionists and who believe in the lost cause as well, who take any measure of racial and social justice progress as an attack and assault on the lie that they've based their entire lives upon and their entire reality upon. And we're seeing those lies absolutely converge in the 21st century with new layers and levels of conspiracy theories, new layers and levels that seek to really dispatch any kind of democratic opposition to the redemptionist lost cause lie in the 21st century. So these are very, very dangerous times we live in, because they're so similar to the first Reconstruction, 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. You know, Congressman Thaddeus Stevens, who was chairman of the House Ways Means Committee during the Civil War, he's saying by 1866, 1867, Black people are being buried in the South by the thousands because of that lost cause lie, which is as soon as the Civil War ends, you start to have that lost cause lie. And that lie is weaponized both through a narrative war, but also violence. And that narrative war is what we're engaged in right now. The stories we're telling each other, our kids, the world, about what does it mean to be an American? What is American history? How does American history inform our present day identity? And it does, right? Those who don't want to talk about the bad parts of our history continue to do bad things in our current contemporary reality. Mm-hmm. Those who do want to confront the more negative parts of our history are trying to change and transform that. That's why Reconstructionists are always trying to build, and redemptionists and supporters of the lost cause are always trying to destroy, both rhetorically and physically through violence.
Yeah, really interesting. Well said. We're almost out of time. Let me get one more call in here. Maureen in Brooklyn, a parent who wants to praise a particular homework assignment that her kids got. Maureen, hi, you're on WNYC, and we have about a minute for you.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, so yes, my daughter, my 11th grader in the New York City Consortium High School, I won't name the school, but she came home with a homework assignment last night, and I was so excited because it was actually, it's a class on the 1960s, and the assignment was reading the Port Perone statement, you know, with SDS, and trying to connect what they were saying then to today and problems that the young youth face compared to, you know, obviously what SDS was fighting for.
Students for a Democratic Society, an anti-war group, and other things at the time.
Yes. Yeah, Tom Hayden and so forth, right? Yes. Really remarkable to see that. And my daughter read the essay and was able to really articulate and show critical thinking as she was completing this assignment. So we do have really good learning that's taking place. We just need more of it. And like, that is the kind of stuff that needs to be louder and talked about more and more supported. And you know, so it is happening, but it would be terrible if it weren't. Right.
I'm curious, Maureen, if that lesson made your daughter feel more secure in a certain way, because so much that's going on right now is so intense. But to look back on the 1960s, which was different, but also intense, perhaps was comforting and empowering to her, because she could look back and learn that, things like this have happened before.
That's exactly what she had gotten out of it. That was the point that she had pulled out of the assignment was, you know, look, these were young people who saw really serious social problems, and they weren't taken seriously. Nobody was listening to them. You know, just like today, you know, because we're young, I mean, it's full ageism, right, against these kids. So that's basically what she was.
Maureen, thank you so much for that call. Great call. And we're over time, but I want to get one last thought from you, John, because besides writing about the issue and how it's been politicized, you wrote up an Education Next public opinion survey about public education, and you put the scary title on your article, "What If Americans Sour on Public Education?" And where it connects with this election issue is, you know, there have been people out there now, Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times and others, who are saying this isn't just about not teaching critical race theory or not teaching sex ed as independent issues. Those are being used by people who want to destroy public education, period, and turn education funding into vouchers that parents would use for private schools, and that some say this is led by the religious school movement because they want more vouchers to, you know, be available to them. Do you see it that way?
So I worry about this. So we are in an era where there's sort of increasing skepticism of American institutions. And for a long time, K-12 public schools have been sort of spared that. So we have what some people call this public school ideology, where Americans are just kind of fond of our public education system. We're proud of the idea that it's at the foundation of our notions of social mobility and equality of opportunity, and that we have these sort of nice little super local institutions all across the country. And in some polling that's been coming out lately, we're starting to see cracks in that support for public schools. And a lot of it is breaking on party lines. So we're seeing a lot more very strong, vehement disapproval from Republicans than we've seen before. And higher education went through this a few years ago. So there was this sort of enormous spike in Republican disapproval of higher education about 5 to 10 years ago. And it's been tough in a lot of red states for public universities. And I think it's a sort of a trend that we need to be keeping an eye on, whether Americans are in fact souring, or certain groups of Americans are souring on public education. And it does have potentially serious consequences. So you mentioned some of the voucher reforms, and some of those reforms. So first of all, they're more possible now, partly because the Supreme Court has been weighing in on some issues involving private school.
Yes, and we have 30 seconds left.
And just to say that some of these programs now are much more expansive and are sort of designed in ways where it seems like they're intended to be antagonistic toward the public education system rather than sort of sit apart from it.
John Vellant is director of the Brown Center on Education Policy and a senior fellow of governance studies, at the Brookings Institution. Peniel Joseph is founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy and a history professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the author of the recent book, The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. Thank you so much for being our guests on Issue 6 in our election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days.
My pleasure. Thanks, Brian.